I am the person who you now call David Hodges. Where I come from, we have mastered the technology of giving a talk on stunt night. I know that's beyond your primitive means now, but I aim to give you a demonstration. This pathetic excuse for a stunt night. I mean, really, come on, in 2050, we've got it down. This was just a long series of bad jokes punctuated by a few short skits. And I didn't know that Dinty Moore and Larry the Cable Guy used the same stylist. Dinty the fashion challenge, she's Dinty the joke challenge. And by the way, about that infomercial, I didn't get to show my videos twice. I'm not bitter. The award for the best use of a stuffed animal that looks nothing like a moose goes to Visit to the In-Laws. However, I have to reserve my highest praise for the Outermost Empire skit. You guys, you looked into my subconscious, you read all my plans. You know, that was supposed to be secret. We will have viewings of the Red Blanket. Danny will be selling tickets in the bookstore. Anyway, oh my goodness. Actually, the Jeezinator skit gets the award for the best screenplay because it actually had two acts. That's pretty good. That's sophisticated stuff. All right. I am going to settle down here for an opening prayer. Jamie Gehring is going to give us an offering. Thank you.
nothing that I wouldn't do. Go to the ends of the earth for you, to make you feel my love, to make you feel my love. Thank you.
I was more nervous about doing that than about speaking. I have three short scriptures for tonight, and so I'm just going to read them from my notebook. The first is from Galatians 5:1. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. John 8:31. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. John 8:36. If the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. If the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. I'm going to tell you a few stories about healing. I've almost died twice in my life. I almost didn't make it into adulthood. The second time, I was in college, and I was working in the wintertime for the Appalachian Mountain Club up here at Mount Washington, New Hampshire. And I was what was called a hutman. And the job of the hutman was to keep the huts stocked. There's a whole chain of huts for hikers and skiers across the White Mountain Range, and the Appalachian Mountain Club keeps them stocked with supplies so that people can stay there overnight. So we had jobs in the base station, but we also carried heavy backpacks of supplies up to the huts. Well, so it was wintertime, and I had a day off, and there's a weather station on top of Mount Washington, which a lot of you people know about. It has some of the coldest temperatures, I don't know, in the globe, somewhere, North America anyway. And so there's United States Weather Service guys, and they're on a rotation of 2 weeks on and a week off. So one of the Weather Service guys came back from his days off, and he said he was going to climb up to the top. Did I want to go with him? And so me and my buddy got our equipment on, and it was an afternoon, sunny winter afternoon, and we were going to climb Mount Washington. Those of you who know Mount Washington already can sense trouble. I was a college kid. I was not a mountain climber. I was pretty inexperienced. So we headed up the head wall of Tuckerman's Ravine. Tuckerman's Ravine is a very steep approach to the summit. It's one of the hardest approaches. And in the winter, it's a great spot for skiing because it's full of snow. It's like a natural amphitheater. So we were climbing up this natural amphitheater full of snow, and Greg, the Weather Service guy, got to the top and saw tons and tons of loose snow perched dangerously on the lip of the top of the ravine. He was very worried about avalanche. So he called down to me and my friend, we were farther down the headwall, and very urgently told us to move laterally across the headwall to get out of the way of all this snow. Well, I knew how to climb up, and I knew how to climb down. I had on crampons. I didn't know how to go laterally. I didn't know how to go sideways in that gear. And so I was going sideways, and I slipped, and I fell. And I was unable to stop myself. And so I rolled and tumbled down the head wall all the way into the bowl of Tuckerman's Ravine on Mount Washington. Fortunately, there was so much snow that all the boulders and bushes were covered, or else I, most surely would have died. As it was, I arrived at the bottom with a lot of cuts, bruises, and unknown injuries. And I was lying in the snow at the bottom, and my friend reached me. And I later knew that I was going in and out of consciousness because he kept saying, "David, stay with me. David, stay with me." And what I remember of that time is him very vaguely and distantly saying, "David, stay with me," as I got up out of my body and walked off into the snow. And then he said, "David, stay with me," and all of a sudden I was back in my body, and I was conscious, and I was hurting. So meanwhile, Greg, the Weather Service guy, had phoned for the Forest Service Rescue Squad, and they arrived in a snowcat, and they rigged up a thing to lower me down to where they could put me on a toboggan and put me on the snowcat and took me into the doctor. So anyway, the key point from that experience for me is that I was foolish. Well, that's a key point. No, but the key point was the fact that my spirit dissociated from my body for a short period of time, and I experienced it as real. So that was the second time. The first time, I was six, and I was very ill as a child. I was born with what's called a duodenal hernia, which meant that parts of my digestive system weren't working correctly and had to be repaired. And the doctors were going to wait till I was big enough to do surgery. So for the first 6 years of my life, I had frequent stomach upsets. But all I remember is at the age of six, lying on the couch with a very bad stomach ache and a sore throat, and they decided I needed emergency surgery, and by the way, they were going to take out my tonsils at the same time, just for their convenience, I guess. I have a very vivid memory of going under the ether. In those days, they just put ether on a pad and put it over your mouth. And I remember the smell of that. And then I remember waking up. And when I woke up, I didn't know this. I was unconscious for several days. I caught a kidney infection as a result of that surgery. And the kidney infection was what nearly killed me. And so I don't know how many days I was out. I didn't know that my parents were dreadfully worried about me. I didn't know anything. I just woke up in a hospital room alone with a huge bandage on my belly, a huge sore throat, and in pain. And so I cried. And I cried and I cried and I cried. I felt terribly abandoned. And all of a sudden, this nurse comes to the door and rushes in and picks me up out of bed, at least that's what I remember, and starts talking to me, saying things like, "Nurse Kelly will take care of you. Nurse Kelly won't let anything bad happen to you. Nurse Kelly is telling you it's all right." Now, in my six-year-old understanding, I didn't know she was talking about herself. I kept looking around saying, "Where's Nurse Kelly?" Yeah. Why does she keep talking about this other person who's coming? I don't get it. But also, I think that's one of my earliest memories of realizing that we have a part of our consciousness that's always observing. It's always neutral. No matter how much pain we're in or how much distress, there's a part of us that's still there saying, "Wow, this is pretty interesting." Mm-hmm. In meditation, we develop that capability a lot to watch our thoughts and watch our experiences. That's a side note. Anyway, eventually my mother rushed in and comforted me, and I stayed in the hospital for about a month recovering, and then I had complete bed rest for another 3 months, and had to go to the doctor every few months for the rest of my childhood to get my blood levels checked, my urine checked and all that because of the kidney problem. Fortunately, I grew out of it, and it doesn't bother me now. So I've also learned what a trial that was for my parents. I didn't know that at the time. Your parents don't tell you, you know, what suffering they went through. You only realize when you become a parent. You know, you talk about the heart of a father. When you become a father, you realize what you would do for your children, and I realized what my parents did for me during that awful time. So I had that experience. Now, I want to tell a bit more of my story. When I was a member of that church, this was probably before the time that I told you about before, when I was so involved in all the activities. I was fairly new in the church, probably about 30, 31 years old. And they announced that they were going to have a Healing of the Memories seminar. If you remember the early 80s, those were pretty big, and a lot of churches were doing them. So I decided to attend this Healing of the Memories seminar simply because all the people I knew were going, and they said I should go. So I went, and the presenter was really good and talked about all that stuff, and I thought, yeah, this is really good for other people to experience. I'm sure it'll help them quite a bit. And then the presenter moved into a workshop where you divided up into groups. And you had your small group, and each group went to a private room somewhere in the church, and you were supposed to do some experiential application of the Healing of the Memories that they were teaching. So I went into this room, and I noticed that I had started to feel really strange. Some kind of sadness was welling up in my heart, and I didn't know what it was. And it was, at first I tried to, you know, put it down and just kind of ignore it, the way guys do. But it wouldn't go away. And the other people in my group noticed that I was really fighting tears. And so they formed a circle around me and started to pray. And as soon as they started to pray, I got an image of myself in that hospital bed, waking up, alone, feeling abandoned, in pain. I hadn't thought about it since it happened. But there it was on the screen of my mind. And so I told the people around me who were praying for me about the image that had just come up. And the leader of our little group said, okay, now picture Jesus in this scene. And so in my imagination, Jesus walked into the room and sat down on my bed, and I crawled into his lap, and he comforted me. And then I started to really cry. And then the people around me started to sing, and this is what they sang. Tears flowed, and we all hugged one another, and I experienced a great inner healing. I didn't know at the time what effects it would have, if any, because I hadn't even been aware of having this issue. That's often the way it is with buried memories and traumatic things, as we push them so far down, we don't even remember them sometimes. And I didn't find out the results of that healing for months. And I'll tell you what the results were. It was surprising because it had nothing to do. I can't make a connection between what happened and what the results were. But here's what it was. At that period in my life, I would get very, very nervous whenever I had to do anything in public, like public speaking. I know it's hard to believe. any kind of service in church or for my business where I had to get up and talk in front of people, I'd be a wreck, and I'd be worried about it for days, and my hands would be sweaty, and, you know, I'd use up three handkerchiefs mopping my brow, and, you know, my voice would shake and all this sort of stuff. And I had to do a lot of that for my work especially. And so in church one day after this incident, I had to get up and make an announcement. I got up and made the announcement and sat down, and all of a sudden realized I wasn't nervous, that I hadn't been. I hadn't even thought about it. I just got up and did it. And then other things like that followed, and then I started doing the things I told you about, you know, Bible studies and Sunday school. And that's when I started doing leadership at CFO, too. I got a lot more confidence. Something in that repressed memory was sapping my confidence. Something in that memory had made me feel unworthy. Something in that memory was making me judge myself as incapable of performing. And healing it took that away and gave me a sense of self-worth and of loving myself, which enabled me to go on and serve more. Now, the explanation for why I was nervous, and I found that out too years later in therapy. My father was a minister. My father was beloved by many people. My father was well known in his circle. And my father, all through my childhood and young adulthood, was the one who stood up and talked before groups like I'm doing with you now. And every time I had to do it, I felt I was competing with him. I felt like I was never going to be as good as my dad. And so I'd be judged for that. That's what went away. That's what went away. No more competition. It was kind of a script that I was running all the time and didn't even know it. I think there's two things that we have to do if we're going to grow. And one of them is we have to accept ourselves, and the other is we have to accept other people. It sounds really simple, but it's so hard. It's so hard to love other people if you don't love yourself. It's so hard to accept other people if you don't accept yourself. A quote from Meredith Young Sowers. She says, one of the greatest spiritual acts of love is to walk away from recrimination and remorse and to accept in its place love and your own self-worth. Walk away from recrimination against others and remorse against yourself and accept in its place love and your own self-worth. The other thing that happened during my years-long struggle with depression is I just stopped trying so hard. I just stopped trying so hard. That was a big release. I stopped trying to be perfect for you guys. You know, it sounds easy, but it's not. I stopped trying to measure up. I started doing rhythms, you know. I didn't care what I looked like anymore. And tonight you saw my dance debut. So I first heard this quote at CFO, but it's a good one. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin says, "We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience." When we talk about accepting ourselves, it implies that there's a self to be accepted and something that's going to accept it. When we're spiritual beings, we have the freedom in Christ that I read in order to accept ourselves as human beings. We accept ourselves as human beings for all our frailties because our spirit knows why we're put here. Our spirit knows what our mission is here on earth. Our spirit doesn't judge us. Our spirit doesn't hold us to account. Our spirit is cheering us on. It's only we and our small selves that are the accusers and the victimizers. So there's lots of ways, and I've been talking to a few people this week, but there's a lot of ways to find the healing that you need in order to go further spiritually. And it's not my purpose to go into all that. But there are ways of thinking that are better than other ways of thinking. For example, one formula for healing that I like says, I no longer believe in that. I am an infinite being, and I'm not subject to that. I no longer believe in that. I'm an infinite being. I'm not subject to that. Another phrase that I like is, even though I'm suffering from whatever it is, I still deeply and completely love and accept myself. I'll say that if I'm in my crazy mind and I'm trying to get out of it. Even though I'm in my crazy mind, I still deeply and completely love and accept myself. Another very powerful statement, it's a prayer really, is I'm willing to understand this in a different way. I'm willing to understand this in a different way. It's a prayer because we don't know what the different way is, but at least being willing to get out of the victimized thinking that we're in that's causing us to suffer. So if we put all those together, I might have said, even though I felt abandoned when I was sick, I still deeply and completely love and accept myself. This story of mine does not touch my core as a spiritual being. It does not affect me as a spiritual being. It has no power over me. I no longer believe in it. I'm an infinite being, and I'm not subject to it. I'm willing to understand it in a different way. These are powerful words, and they work. And once you've understood this process and got it to work one time for you, you get a taste of freedom. And once you get a taste of freedom, you never go back. Once you know what your freedom is and that you have a place in you that you can reach that's free, you're on a path of healing. As I've said, in every situation, there's this choice, there's this freedom between sanity and insanity. If you're in your crazy place, you can choose to get out of it. I promised to be brief, so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. There's a great book that I've got, I don't know if it made it into the bookstore, called How People Change by Alan Wheelis. Dana's shaking his head. In this book, Alan Wheelis talks about how you can take two people who are roughly the same and put them in the same situation and they'll have very different reactions to it. So you take two people, give them the same house to live in, the same family, the same job, the same assortment of problems. One person will be weighed down and burdened and oppressed and will feel trapped and will feel like they have no alternatives. The other person will be happy, productive, optimistic, forward-looking, will have a meaningful life, and might even have plans to get out of the situation and make it a lot better. Same situation, two people. What's the difference? The difference is one person understands their freedom. Necessity are those things that you can't change. And there's a lot of things we can't change. I can't make myself grow taller. I can't make myself grow younger, although in the year 2050, I'll be able to master that. That's necessity, and everybody has certain things that constrain them. You know, we have illnesses and financial problems and whatnot, but you're always free inside. You're always free inside. That's what the gospel readings that I read said to you. You always are free inside to choose the better way. Glenn Clark said in A Man's Reach that there was a certain point in his life where he had a revelation that completely changed him, and he said it was as easy as getting up on the other side of the bed. And that one day he got up on the other side of the bed, metaphorically, and reached a higher level of power in his life. And that's when he became the Glenn Clark that we know. He realized his freedom, and he started making different choices. So I just want to leave you by saying, I choose freedom and not obsession. I choose my sanity, not my craziness. I choose to see the beauty of this day instead of obsessing over trivia. I choose peace instead of worry. I choose acceptance instead of attack. I choose to think of myself as a spiritual being. I choose to walk in the way of freedom. I choose gratitude. I choose to give. I choose love. I wrote this in my journal today. I want is the root of all suffering. I give is the root of all joy. I choose is the root of all freedom. Thank you, and good night, and go to your square dance, and have a great time.